From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the state's chief medical executive updates us on the COVID case curve.
Anytime we see people gathering in large groups, not socially distancing, not wearing masks, we certainly are concerned about the fallout of that.
Also, systemic racism in the healthcare system, even among Black families of means.
Wealth does afford a certain privilege, but it doesn't undo all of the harm associated with the system that, by its very design, has bias built into it.
And the secret lives of morels. Could a wild-grown Michigan delicacy flourish on farms?
Could we possibly co-crop morels with other agriculture commodities, such as under strawberries or alongside fruit trees?
Those stories and more just ahead on today's edition of Stateside. Stay with us. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Policing is in the national spotlight, but it's not the only aspect of life where your skin color affects how you're treated. Today, we're kicking off a summer series about how systemic racism shapes the world around us, starting with healthcare.
Even wealthier African Americans will typically have worse health outcomes, report poor patient-provider communication, are less likely to get specialty services.
Stay with us. We have more on that later in the hour. But first, Michigan's COVID caseload has been on a bit of a roller coaster ride the past couple of weeks. While our state is thankfully benefiting from lower death rates compared with spring and compared with some other states in the U.S., there are counties in Michigan experiencing outbreaks that leave many wondering if we'll be back in lockdown before the summer's over. Joining us today is one of the architects of the state's public health policies, Michigan's chief medical executive, Dr. Joan A. Khaldun. Dr. Khaldun, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk a little bit, for starters, about Sunday's results. There were no COVID-related deaths reported yesterday since, I believe that's the first time since March that that's happened, correct?
Yes, that is correct. There were no COVID-related deaths reported on that day. But I do want to caution people that the date of the report does not actually mean that no one actually died on that day. So we are going back and looking at retrospectively all of our cases and deaths. But I expect there to be more deaths, given that we're seeing more cases every day.
Right. And there were, I believe, several hundred new cases reported. So it's not as if the picture was entirely rosy, even by the numbers. Over the 4th of July, we certainly saw a lot of people gathering with friends and family, and there were campsites and beaches that were absolutely buzzing. Are you expecting a statewide spike over the next 2 weeks?
It's something I'm certainly concerned about. Anytime we see people gathering in large groups, not socially distancing, not wearing masks, we certainly are concerned about the fallout of that, which is increasing cases. So we will be closely watching the data as we continue to do. We continue to encourage people to socially distance and wear their masks. And hopefully we do not see a spike in cases. But from some of the pictures that I've seen, it would not be a surprise if we see outbreaks associated with what happened over the weekend.
Michigan's experienced a couple different waves of infection recently, which may or may not track with what listeners see, depending on what county they're in. And we keep hearing phrases like first wave, second wave, surge, and spike. I wondered if, first of all, if those are phrases that you use and that you find meaningful, and second of all, if you think they're helpful in the public's understanding.
Right, so I certainly understand that people use different phrases like you described. From my perspective, you know, we saw a surge, if you will, in cases in the early spring, and we saw those cases decline, and now we're still seeing cases every day. So I continue to be full court press, if you will, when it comes to cases and deaths and tracking. I know a lot of people talk about prevent a second surge in the fall. Well, as far as I'm concerned, what we do now is absolutely important as well. So I don't want to necessarily put off the hard work until the fall. It's an ongoing public health response.
Right. What do the waves mean?
So it's all about case rates and how many cases you're seeing and the surge in cases. Again, it refers to the curve, if you will, with the number of cases that you see per day. And as you noted, We saw those go up significantly in late March and early April in the state, and then they slowly kind of came down. So it literally refers to the shape of the curve, if you will, when it comes to cases. And so we have been at a plateau, kind of at the bottom of a curve over the past several weeks. But again, over the past couple of weeks, specifically more recently, we're starting to see an increase in the number of cases, which is very concerning.
Can you update us on how many tests are being performed in the state each day?
Yeah, so it varies every day, obviously. We recently surpassed our initial goal of 15,000 tests per day, and for several days have hit actually 16,000 tests per day, which is something that's very, very important. We continue to encourage people, especially those who are working in high-risk industries where they're out interacting with the public, certainly people who may have been exposed themselves to someone who has symptoms or who has confirmed COVID-19, for them to seek out a test. And we have several sites across the state. And you can also find out where those sites are on our coronavirus website.
Some of the counties that have been hit hard, even though they're sparsely populated, are in the more rural parts of the state. I saw Oceana County had over 340 cases reported recently, which, given that it's a county of about 26,000 people, is a lot. What do we know about contagion in rural areas?
Well, what we know is no one is immune, regardless of where you live. Just one person can spread the disease to several other people. So it doesn't matter if you're living in a more densely populated area like the southeast part of the state, or you're living in the Upper Peninsula. And so it basically means that, you know, we're all at risk of getting the disease. And when you have one person, whether it's in a workplace, which is what we've seen in several places, whether it's at a bar or a restaurant, whether it's a family gathering, people are not immune regardless of where they live. And especially in our more rural areas, we're even more concerned because we know hospital capacity is also not as great as it is in Southeast Michigan. So it's something we have to watch very closely.
Is contact tracing easier to do in the rural counties?
I don't know if I would say that it's easier necessarily. What we've seen over the past several weeks is that for every case of COVID-19, whereas they used to have only three close contacts on average, now every case they were investigating across the state has four contacts. So that means that more and more people are out and more people are coming in contact with other individuals. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily easier. It's all about the context. If that person went to a party or, you know, had several people at their home, then the risk is still there regardless of where that person may live. Hmm.
Last month, you put the response rate for contact tracing at 60%. And I understand that was just for the volunteers who were working for the state. Now, it happens that a lot of this work is also happening at the local health department level. How do you feel like we're doing with contact tracing statewide?
Yeah, so we have been really expanding our contact tracing efforts across the state, providing staffing to the local health departments. Again, this is their bread and butter work that they do every day. Anyway, we've got over 10,000 volunteers that have signed up, and then we're also working on hiring volunteers as well. We've also had to update our technology systems. They're quite outdated, and it made it challenging to be able to do the work. So we've updated that and are rolling that out across the state. I think we're in a good place for now. The challenges with contact tracing that we have currently are not necessarily the number of staff, but it's more about, is someone actually answering the phone when we call them? Is that person who has COVID-19 actually telling us about their other contacts? And are those people actually answering the phone? So there's a lot of things about just the general public responding to our contact tracing efforts that we continue to work through. But there's no question, we know that as we move forward over the next several months, we will need more contact tracers. And that's why we've got money that's going out the door to local health departments to build up their capacity there as well.
Has it been difficult to get results from the counties?
We you say results? No, I would not say it's been difficult at all. Our local health departments are doing an amazing job. Again, on the front lines, they're responding to outbreaks. They're doing the contact tracing. They know the ins and outs and the details of all of the outbreaks across the state. And quite frankly, that's why we know about them, is because they're doing their due diligence and increasing testing, whether it's at a bar or family outing. They're the ones who are actually on the front lines doing the work. So I would not say that's been a problem at all.
We're at a stage where people talk about their fatigue with being at home, their frustration about their jobs and the economy. And sometimes even things just as simple as a mask get downright nasty when people are talking to friends and family about it. How are you getting through to people about the seriousness of the situation, which has not really ended?
Right. I certainly understand people being tired of wearing a mask and, you know, wanting to go about their usual lives before COVID-19. But I can tell you, we've all got to just be patient. We have to remain vigilant. I'm incredibly concerned about what I'm seeing with people not wearing masks and gathering in large crowds indoors. There's no question that's going to contribute to more outbreaks. And we've seen that already across the state in several instances. I think people just have to be patient. Wearing a mask is better than being in a hospital and on a ventilator. So wear your mask. You're protecting not just yourself, you're protecting your family members and your communities. So I just think it's something that I hope people don't make a political thing, but really make it something that's for the better of the health of our communities.
We know that Governor Whitmer was considering rolling back some of the openings, given the fact that we were starting to see many counties' infection rates tick back up again. Do you anticipate that we'll be hearing from the governor anytime this week on that?
Well, we continue to monitor the data. Obviously, the governor had really wanted to move the entire state forward to phase five, and we were unable to do that because of what the data was showing us. And so we'll continue to monitor and move forward from a policy perspective as necessary.
Mm-hmm. If we do see a continued spike, do you feel like it can be, we're at a place where we can trace it back directly to people's compliance with the physical distancing orders and the suggestions for masks right now?
Often we can. Again, this is the work of the contact tracers. We whenever there's a positive case, we go back and ask someone where they've been. And often it's, you know, it's a bar or there's been some type of community. There's been some type of gathering that we find out about. But sometimes it's still the case that we don't actually know how someone got the disease. And it's indication that there's actually community spread, which is something that's very concerning. Every case is not necessarily associated with a specific outbreak or a public gathering.
Dr. Khaldun, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Jonae Khaldun is Chief Medical Executive for the state of Michigan. In a minute, researchers talk to us about why it's so difficult to cultivate one of the state's tastiest forage commodities, morel mushrooms. These MSU researchers are working on that very question.
It's partly that we don't fully understand their life cycle.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. What to do in those moments when there's not a lot going on? That's a question preoccupying a lot of us right now. If you farm in Michigan, particularly if you work in specialty crops, you may have a busy early summer, but there are months when your fields may not be full of asparagus, fruiting cherry trees, or other things. Now, if you stroll farmers markets in your town, you may notice that there's very small products that go for very large prices. There are researchers trying to figure out if it's possible for Michigan farmers to take advantage of downtimes to boost their incomes growing the coveted and super tasty morel mushroom. With us today are Greg Benito, an assistant professor at Michigan State University in the Department of Plant, Soil, and Microbial Sciences. He specializes in mycology. That's your plant-fungal interactions. Greg, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here with you.
And we also have Scott Swinton with us. He's a professor of agricultural economics at Michigan State, who has also been taking part in the project. Scott, nice to have you.
April, happy to be on board.
How did you two hit on the idea that morel mushrooms might be an avenue for research?
Well, Greg had been doing research on morels before, and I think he had visited China. And we are neighbors, and we got to talking about this at the Labor Day picnic in 2018, I think. And he said, you know, we could do a USDA project.
Mushrooms over potato salad. I love it. So guys, I know that morels are widely available in nature every spring for anybody who's got the time and interest in going out to forage them. But Greg, isn't it relatively hard to cultivate them as a crop?
For nearly 100 years or longer, people have been trying to cultivate morels with small successes, but nothing really economically feasible.
Why is it so difficult to grow them?
It's partly that we don't fully understand their life cycle. That has been a large part of the challenge. There's a couple groups that have been cultivated, but some of them still, the yellow morels, have not been reliably cultivated yet.
Are morels very different than other kinds of mushrooms?
Morels are ascomycetes, so they're in a different phylum than regular mushrooms as you think of them, such as the button mushrooms or even boletes or chanterelles. So they're quite distantly related, similar to how chordates are different from insects, arthropods, and which are different from corals. They're in different phyla.
Got it. Greg, I know you and one of your research partners went after a grant to see if there were ways that Michigan farmers might actually grow mushrooms. And in the course of that, you visited some farms in China that have had success in this. What did you see farmers doing there?
Oh, it was very interesting because I had heard for a few years how Chinese farmers and researchers were working together to grow morels, but I didn't really believe it until I saw it.
What kinds of methods were they using?
Well, they grow the spawn up and they bury it in the soil. And one of the main things they do is they feed the morel mycelium with these nutrition packs. And that's one of the main parts of their method that is important for production.
Vitamin packs for mushrooms. We should all have it so good. I have to say, this is all new to me. When I think about cultivating mushrooms, I tend to think of an underground cave, lots of soil, and possibly unsavory fertilizers. But I gather that that has absolutely no basis in the reality of mushroom cultivation.
Well, there are indoor mushroom cultivation operations that simulate this kind of existence of a cave where you have controlled temperature and humidity and diffuse light. But what we're talking about is outdoor cultivation. So trying to work with nature, which would lower cost because it's very expensive to maintain climate control conditions.
What did you need for a demonstration project of this kind in Michigan?
Well, we needed a place to carry out our research, and we needed a little support to help fund our personnel. Our supplies, it's not that expensive to grow the mycelium, but we're trying to do it in under high tunnels. And so we've got some collaborators in crop and soil sciences and horticulture that have let us use their high tunnels for our research.
What kinds of farms tend to make a good candidate for this kind of mushroom farming? Are there particular sectors in Michigan agriculture that would have a chance? Scott, could you jump in and tell us a little bit about who might be the right person to grow mushrooms?
Well, what we're seeing so far is that mushrooms require a lot of effort. So I think it would fit for smaller farms and farms that are in areas that have woods. We're experimenting with different levels of shade, but naturally morels grow in shaded areas.
Does this necessarily mean Western Michigan?
Oh, I don't think it's limited to any particular part of the state. And, you know, the other key issue here is price. Up to now, most morels sold have been wild foraged. Many of them go for really premium prices, often to gourmet restaurants. So part of what we're interested in seeing is how that market, the broader market, could grow, particularly if farmers were able to sell morels at farm markets and reach a larger population at lower prices.
I feel like I've seen them for sale for $40 to $50 a pound. Does that sound about right?
It does. You might have gotten a bargain at $30 a pound.
Scott, to what extent are Michigan specialty crop farmers already in a need to diversify?
Many Michigan specialty crop farmers are facing hard times. The tart cherry growers are facing very serious global competition. Prices for a whole range of crops, not just specialty crops, row crops too, are relatively low lately. So there are different ways to deal with price risk, but diversification is one of them. And I think it's a particularly good strategy for small scale farmers.
Greg, what are some of the questions on your mind as you're entering into this?
Well, as you mentioned, Michigan has different climates, different soils. And so we're trying to partner with farmers across the region, in the Midwest in general, to see when do we need to plant the morels so we get harvest. Are we going to be able to have spring harvest and fall harvest? Could we cultivate morels in forest settings, which would lower the startup costs? Could we possibly co-crop morels with other agriculture commodities, such as under strawberries or alongside fruit trees? These are some of the questions that we're asking, or possibly after a wheat harvest or corn. So we're looking into these with the research, and we hope to address some of these questions.
When you think about the demand for morels, and Scott, you mentioned that, you know, they are a delicacy. Some fine restaurants will buy them. Are there ways to think about different consumer markets than have been in the morel business before now?
Yes. And I'd say a first step going beyond that highly specialized market is moving to farmer markets and moving to specialized groceries. In the Lansing area, there's just one grocery that sells morels.
Hey, would either of you have any thoughts for people who maybe have never had a morel before but are curious at least about trying them? What are the preferred ways to enjoy them?
Well, one thing, you should always cook morels before you consume them. They're not to be eaten raw. That could make you get indigestion. But last night, I just cooked up some morel risotto from some of our spring harvests, which is a nice way to eat them.
Well, that sounds pretty amazing.
Just sauteed. They're delicious.
Greg, will you give up your sources for us? It sounds like you may have a line on this.
My sources?
Yeah.
For morels. Well, morels hunters rarely give up their sources. These were actually cultivated as part of our project that we set up last year. So we're trying to keep track of what we're producing. And I got a little of the bounty. I was fortunate in that way. morels, they're hollow inside, unlike other mushrooms. So another way that they're consumed and enjoyed is by stuffing them with whatever your favorite stuffing is, cheeses, meats, other goodies.
There may be folks who might want to try their hand at growing them themselves, hearing that this is something that you guys are working on too. Is it the sort of thing that a person could at least try if they wanted to start their own backyard mushroom grow operation?
You could try it. And there's a lot of companies that sell spawn, but that hasn't been very fruitful in the past. One of the things with morels is they are sexual organisms. So all of the strains we use, we have a lab and we're able to test that they've already mated. So our strains are fertile strains. And it's an interesting thing with their biology because this was not really known a few years back. So we're using special strains that are already fertilized. So trying it in the backyard is you can do it, but don't have great expectations.
Wait, this is a whole other aspect of mushroom emotional life that I was not aware of. Are they sexual organisms in the same way that we think of some fruit trees that need to pollinate?
They need to outcross. That's right. That's part of their biology that we are now understanding. But it's not fully understood. We don't really know how wide they can outcross. You know, can different species outcross or species complexes? They have an asexual phase of their life cycle that has recently been documented for a lot of the species. And we don't really understand why they produce all these spores asexually. And so this is some of the basic biology that we're learning and trying to understand so we can use it to improve the cultivation process.
What's the time horizon for this project?
This is a 3-year project that's ongoing and supported by USDA Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education.
So it's likely to be a while before we know the results of it. Guys, I feel like I'm looking forward to checking in on the lives of these mushrooms and what you find out about it. Thank you for telling us about what you're working on.
Thank you, April. I hope we have good information for you in 2 to 3 years' time.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The past few months have shined a light on systemic racism within American policing, but criminal justice is far from the only sector of American society that is touched by these problems. And in healthcare, as in policing, systemic racism can be a matter of life or death. This week, we're kicking off a series of conversations that'll last throughout the summer about how racism in systemic, institutional, and everyday forms touches all of our lives. And we're starting with healthcare. Deborah Fur Holden is professor of public health at Michigan State University. She's also an associate dean for public health integration and director of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions. Deborah Fur Holden, it is a pleasure. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also speaking today with Charlie Snow. She is director of midwifery services at Henry Ford Health System and is the founder of Metro Detroit Midwives of Color. Charlie Snow, it's good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to ask both of you a question to start off with about maybe an early moment when you were aware of how systemic racism plays out in healthcare, and whether that's in a professional setting or a more personal story, it's up to you. Deborah, is there something that you could share with us about observations you've made of this?
Systemic racism and the issue of implicit bias is a tricky one, right? Because the whole thing about bias, implicit bias or unconscious bias, is that it's hidden from the person. But the impact is very real on people. And so I don't know if you've been following, there's a really great hashtag going around on Twitter right now, Black in the Academy.
Yes.
And one of the things that came to mind for me is the experience of being a 46-year-old Black woman who has a terminal degree that I've had for now 20 years. I'm 21 years post-op. And I was actually the opening plenary speaker at a very large Big Ten conference. I had on a black suit and a white shirt. I have on my hard plate, MSU bag, et cetera. And someone came up to me and asked me to get them a cup of coffee. And so I don't think there was any malice or bad intent, but that's the kind of things that we talk about that just people see you. They interact with you, they make judgments based on these very superficial factors, and it shapes and influences how they interact with you. Now, for me, that was sort of funny. And I said, sure, I'll get you a cup of coffee. And I turned to one of the other staff who happened to also have on a black suit and a hard name plate. And I said, could you get, you know, one of our attendees a cup of coffee? And then I noticed when I went on stage to give the opening address, the look of horror on the face of the person who had asked me to get them a cup of coffee. But those incidents are all too common, and they're very common in healthcare. You'll have black physicians and nurses who will come in and a patient will look to a second or third year medical student and ask for support, not knowing that they're speaking right past the African-American well-trained attending physician in the room.
Charlie Snow, is there a story that you could share?
Absolutely. From the perspective of looking at how patients experience bias and being witness to bias, there are so many subtleties in patient care experiences that come to mind. Thinking of implicit bias as being the shortcuts that we take in stressful situations and the stereotypes that we find ourselves relying on that we may or may not be aware of. Just assumptions around marital status, African-American couples oftentimes not engaging a husband or significant other, just an assumption that they're simply there as the father of the baby, drug screening policies regarding African-American women, particularly instantly, an assumption that drug screening is necessary overutilization of social work for resource visits for African American women without any reported use or need for resources from a social worker. And so there's so many subtle interactions that I've been witness to on the day to day regarding the patient care experience with implicit bias.
Charlie, there's been a bit more media attention, and within Michigan, we could say a bit more political attention lately to the field that you work in, and the especially heart-wrenching statistics. What do we know about the experiences of Black women in maternity wards and the maternal mortality rates when compared with white mothers?
So what we know is Black women are dying at a rate 3 times higher than their non-Black counterparts. And what we know is that these women who are experiencing care, we have had several discussions regarding the social determinants, but what we have failed to look at is the quality of care and what women experience when they are approaching care and interacting and engaging in care in health systems. And so what we do know is African-American women specifically report that they are not feeling heard. They are not feeling as if they are being counseled appropriately, and they are not being involved as they should in decision-making regarding their families, their bodies, and their outcomes.
My guests today are Charlie Snow, Director of Midwifery Services at Henry Ford Health System, and Deborah Furr Holden, Professor of Public Health at Michigan State University. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll continue our conversation about systemic racism and how it leads to worse health outcomes for Black Americans. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's get back into our conversation about how systemic racism impacts the quality of health care that Black Americans receive. We've been talking with MSU Professor of Public Health Deborah Furr Holden and with Charlie Snow. She's Director of Midwifery Services at Henry Ford Health System. Before the break, we got into some of the ways implicit bias in physicians can impact health outcomes and experiences for their Black patients. But the issue extends beyond the attitudes of individual doctors. Let's pick it up from there. It might be easy to say that there is a huge gap in wages and wealth in the United States between Black Americans and white Americans. And so, you know, perhaps the root of all this is who has money. Deborah Furr Holden, does money buy our way out of bad health care as Black people experience it?
Well, we have something called the health wealth gradient. And basically what we understand is that wealth does afford a certain privilege as it relates to health and healthcare access, but it doesn't undo all of the harm associated with the system that by its very design has bias built into it. So even wealthier African Americans will typically have worse health outcomes, report poor patient provider communication, are less likely to get specialty services. We have been in the midst of an opioid epidemic that predated COVID that's still continuing. African Americans are substantially less likely to get prescribed opioids for pain management, even when dealing with chronic health conditions. So income, to some extent, has leveled the playing field a bit, but it does not, by any stretch of the imagination, undo all of the harm associated with systemic racism. And if we're talking about maternal and child health specifically, more affluent African-American women have similar birth outcomes to poor white women. So there's something beyond income and an interaction between race, income, and racism in the healthcare system that I think is the primary driver for these disparate outcomes that we see with African-Americans.
Will you share with us a little bit about what we know of Flint's outcomes compared with other cities?
Flint, in and of itself, is very different from the county in which it's located. We are doing disproportionately worse on many major leading health indicators like maternal and child health, maternal and fetal morbidity, and some of these other indicators. And I think a large part of that is the intersection of race and class. Flint is a majority minority city, but the whites in Flint also typically are very poor. And so I think Flint gives us an opportunity to understand what happens when you get this systemic divestment in a city. Something that a lot of people don't know is the population of Genesee County has remained pretty stable over the last 40 years. What happened, however, is as GM pulled out of Flint, a lot of people left that could left the city of Flint, and they didn't go very far. They went just to the community still within Genesee County, but outside of Flint. And then the structural thing that happened is it used to be that there was this sort of regional countywide approach to taxation and distribution of resources. When that was the case, Flint was the major driver of tax revenue for Genesee County. Now we don't use that approach. So every small sub community within the county gets whatever they put in. So this regional approach to taxation had Flint take care of Genesee County. And now that Flint needs to be taken care of, we have a whole new system in place when in fact Flint now could benefit from an approach like that. We are now on the short end of resource allocation.
You've both been involved in remedies for health disparities and implicit bias, and I wanted to move us into that. Deborah, I know you're part of the state task force, which predates COVID, aimed at enacting some solutions. What role do primary care doctors play in the care that Black Michiganders get?
They play a big role. These folks are at the front line. And I want to acknowledge that I think, you know, we've got a lot of healthcare heroes, people who go and do the job and put themselves and their own loved ones in harm's way to provide care for our citizens and our residents. And so this is not in any way, shape, or form an indictment. But the role of the healthcare professional and the people at the front line, it's such a critical role. If we're going to actually dismantle a system that places a hierarchy on the value of people's lives and what services are offered to them and how they're treated, we've got to start by making sure that these very well-meaning and hardworking people have every tool, every resource, and every opportunity to provide the highest quality and the most equitable care.
What does it mean to give our primary care docs the tools for equity work?
You know, I always give the example of imagine if you're driving, right? We all learned in driver's ed, you have a blind spot, right? It's that area just behind you, just on the side of your car. Well, how do you address a blind spot? Well, we all got trained. You look over your shoulder. And so I think of implicit bias as a blind spot. It's there. It's impactful based on people's actions. But people need the training to look over their shoulder and be vigilant and be on the hunt for it. Because literally, you could have one person doing intake and triage in an emergency department, making major decisions about who gets what. And if that person has a blind spot that they don't see, we've got a gatekeeper now stopping people from getting into a system of care. So implicit bias testing, feedback, and training is, to me, one of the very critical tools that we need to provide people. Yeah. And then I also don't want to pretend that all of the problem is unconscious or hidden. Some of it is overt and right out there on the surface. So I also think that hospitals and healthcare systems and healthcare professionals need to be doing the work to look at their institution and just what do the data tell us? Do you have differences in opioid prescribing practices based solely on the race or the insurance status of the patient? If you do, it becomes a call to action. And I just fundamentally believe health and healthcare access is a right. It's not a privilege. But the way our system is set up, it very much is experienced as a privilege and not as a right.
Charlie, as I mentioned, you helped to found this network in Detroit of Black midwives. Would you tell us about the work that they're doing? I was curious about the mix of direct care and advocacy that the group is taking on.
Yes. So myself, along with two other certified nurse midwives, we started the organization Metro Detroit Midwives of Color. We are all graduates of Wayne State University. And honestly, we didn't have any awareness of the disparities in maternal child health care specifically until after we graduated. There was no presentation during our training. There was no one alerted us to what we were actually approaching as we entered our professions. And so we kind of felt stranded. So we felt like we were alone in what we were experiencing, and we wanted to create a local network of midwives of color so that we could support each other as we navigated this new system for ourselves. But the premise was that once we came together, we then wanted to go right back out into the community. We wanted to start hosting community initiatives that would address these disparities, that would mobilize the resources into the community for people that could not approach the institutions or didn't feel comfortable approaching institutions. And so we led off with kicking off a midwifery week, and we hosted health fairs. We provide educational support to any type of events that community organizations have reached out to us, whether they're community baby showers, talking about family planning. We've been invited to schools. But then also there was this piece about diversifying our profession. And so we wanted to find ways to provide scholarships. So we hosted our annual gala, and we find sponsors to help give scholarships to aspiring midwives of color. And so those premises of creating a network, supporting the community, and diversifying our professions are why we were founded. And pre-COVID, we were doing all those things. But just as Deborah mentioned, being a professional organization of midwives that are working on the front lines, we were all called to duty. And so during that time, we found ways to financially support other community-based organizations that have mobilized, specifically the International Board Certified Lactation Consultants of Color is an organization that is emerging. Breastfeeding rates in Detroit are low for African-American women due to a lack of resources and support. Birth Detroit is another emerging community-based grassroots effort to build and organize a birth center in the city of Detroit. It's another opportunity to address these disparities and inequities in care. We have definitely found ways to uplift these community initiatives, grassroots initiatives.
When you're out in the community, you know, talking to mothers and fathers, you know, maybe some of them first-time mothers and fathers, talking to them about engaging with the healthcare system. And they may have had experiences where, you know, they've seen how family members have been treated in a disparate way, or they may have those experiences themselves. Is it difficult to ask them to engage with the healthcare system?
It is personally difficult to ask them to engage. It's personally difficult because there are challenges that I know they may experience once they enter care. It'd be great if I could say, hey, yeah, no, I'm going to catch your baby and I'll be there. But I know the reality is I'm not there and I'm not present all the time. And so what I think that highlights and what that calls is for systems to diversify. There has to be diversification of our clinical and our leadership teams so that we can more confidently encourage African-American families to approach care, because they can then have experiences from people that look like them, understand them, and they're less likely to have those experiences of implicit bias.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Charlie Snow, Director of Midwifery Services at Henry Ford Health System, and Deborah Furholden. She's Director of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions and a Professor of Public Health at MSU. There are so many factors playing into the inequities that we see. Access to care, physician bias, affordability, physical proximity to healthy resources, food and outdoor spaces where people can exercise and recreate. I wanted to ask both of you, which of these do you consider the easiest to tackle, and perhaps which ones are the most entrenched? Deborah, what are your thoughts on that?
I think one of the first things is that this notion that what is driving the disparities are these individual level determinants of health. It's really time for us to rethink that, because we've seen with COVID, and we've got good data that tell us that your zip code is a much stronger predictor of how long you can expect to live and the quality of life that you can expect to live than is your genetic code. So I think it's imperative that we start to deal with some of the systematic and structural impediments that prevent people from experiencing optimal opportunities for health. We definitely need to address access barriers. We've got Medicaid expansion in Flint, but Medicaid is underutilized. But that's because they've been treated so poorly in the system of care. Many people have sort of lost hope or given up hope, or they accept that the system is not going to, you know, meet their needs. And one of the things that I think is imperative upon us to do is take on a real data-driven decision-making process. We need to have a fearless and unbiased self-inventory of variations in care based on race, gender identity, income, insurance status, because the problem is oftentimes the solutions that we identify for these problems don't match the level of the problem. The problems are often systematic and structural, but the solutions many times are individual level solutions.
Charlie, what comes to your mind when you think about the lower hanging fruit that can be tackled directly and things that will need a more long-term approach?
I definitely agree with Deborah. Within our health system, the social determinants, health being where you live, where you grow, how you work, how you play, have up until this point been the low-hanging fruit, and they've been the focus of our discussion. And now, thankfully, we are moving to discussions regarding inequities, regarding the isms that have led us to these social determinants of health. So within our system, we have instituted programming that addresses these social determinants of health. We have group prenatal care, which is a proven evidence-based model that can help improve outcomes for African-American women specifically. But what takes a little more time and obviously more effort and awareness personally and institutionally is how to address the whys of how we got here. And so our group prenatal care model provides women with midwifery care for clinical care and also a community health worker to help address those social determinants. But we still need to continue to pull back those layers of how that person got there. So what we are now instituting and working to institute at Henry Ford is the unconscious bias training. We'll be starting out with women's health because of the inequities and the disparities. So we're working to develop a model that we can then carry across the entire system, because just as Deborah said, that is something that should be instituted across an entire system so that we can try to move that needle that hasn't moved yet.
Anyone who's been watching public health remembers that when Flint was going through the water crisis, there were some things that changed. And there were some things that did not. So many people in public health were sadly not surprised by the way that COVID has just ravaged Black families because of those disparities. Are there ways that you think of that COVID might be able to instruct us on solutions? Deborah, can you maybe have some final thoughts for us on this?
Yeah, so I think what COVID did, we've all been caught at our most vulnerable. It doesn't matter if you're wealthy, white, poor, ethnic background. You know, this is a tough time for our nation and our world. And it's unfortunate and sad in some ways, but it's also very reassuring and it gives me hope, because people have now gotten to see an inescapable truth that we live in a world where we place a hierarchy on the value of human life, a world where people don't have fair and equal access to all the things that people need to be healthy. So I think what we've seen during COVID-19 is an amplification of pre-existing both disparities that you see in health and life and quality of life, but it's starting to now point to the upstream inequities that have given rise to what we see downstream in these differences in quality of life. And so I think this is a great opportunity that's upon us, because the same types of solutions that we're mounting to both curtail the COVID-19 pandemic, but also to narrow the gap in disparities in COVID-19 will be very similar to the types of strategies that we'll have to employ over time if we really want to sustain and promote and develop, you know, the kind of sustainable healthcare solutions that deals with the systemic and structural factors that gave rise to these disparities in the first place.
Ladies, I feel like we've scratched the surface of some things. I want to thank you both for your work and for taking some time to get us move this conversation along a little bit further. I hope we can touch base again.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We're in this together. I'm super excited. Like, we are too strong of a nation to not emerge better and stronger. And the groundswell of opportunity now to make a more equitable society. I just appreciate you for having this conversation, and we'll come back anytime you'd like.
Deborah Furr Holden is professor of public health at MSU and director of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions. We've also been speaking with Henry Ford Health System's Charlie Snow, director of midwifery services. She also co-founded Metro Detroit Midwives of Color. That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks very much for joining us. Hope you had a fantastic weekend. We'll catch you tomorrow.